Swami Shanta Swarupananda. Benign. Benign is the word I would use to characterize Swami Shanta Swarupananda, who served the Vedanta Society of Northern California from 1946 to 1971 as first assistant to Swami Ashokananda. His name signifies peace, one who is pacified, and certainly he was full of peace. But that is not where it stopped. Blessing and grace came from him. It was not passivity, and so I'm calling it benignity. Before Swami arrived from India, Swami Ashokananda had told us that the new Swami would be unlike him. Much more calm and controlled, he said. However that may be, it was obvious from the first day that Swami Shanta Swarupananda intended to play second fiddle. And he did it magnificently for 24 years. He took up residence in the smaller bedroom on the third floor of the old temple. In San Francisco, I never heard him make a complaint about food, although the diet was surely unfamiliar and bland beyond belief. It must have improved when he was asked by Swami Ashokananda to live in Berkeley, across the bay. He moved to the temple compound built over there only 7 years before. The devotees living across the bay began to care for his needs and help him adjust to life in California. The Swami was affectionate to all of our monastic members. One day when I was prone on the bed with one of my worst headaches, he came into the room, placed his palm on my forehead, reassuring himself that I had no fever. Swami Shanta Swarupananda was not accustomed to public speaking and probably never attained the facility or popularity of some other Swamis. But his English was less accented than his superiors. Some newcomers found him easier to understand. I have heard that after Swami Shanta Swarupananda's arrival, the senior Swami asked him to take some lessons in speech and pronunciation, and he did. He had an excellent education and one of the finest of minds. His Thursday night classes were informative and full of wisdom. The Sunday afternoon lecture in Berkeley was for a time given alternately by the two Swamis. Swami Shanta Swarupananda would go to the city to spell Swami Ashokananda, the more so as the years told on the latter's health. The cabin at Lake Tahoe is on the western side of the lake, high on a hill above a spot called Carnelian Bay. The center owns the cabin, had it built, in fact. In 1946, the summer in which I spent a month there, I was alone in the cabin for nearly the whole time, except for some days when Swami Shanta Swarupananda came to spend a short vacation. Our living together was much as it had been before, lots of silence. A daily walk was his only respite from meditating and reading. He did not use the Swami bedroom of Swami Ashokananda, but slept in the tiny second bedroom. On this occasion, I did not cook his food. Devotees occupied other cabins nearby and had the privilege of preparing and serving it to him. There was a small country store at the bottom of the hill near the lakeside, and at that site, a kind of wharf. It enclosed a portion of quiet water where the summer residents could swim. One hot afternoon, the idea of going in for a dip became so appealing that I simply told him I was planning to go for a swim. He did not look happy. However, I think he must have felt by this time that this novice was incorrigible anyway, and he gave no real expression of disapproval. He did make some remark about the essence of monastic life and cautioned me to take good care while swimming. Now, although I enjoyed the swim and the company of chattering swimmers all the time, the overall effect on my mind was not good. I wished I had obeyed his hints and mood and not his words. It was a great lesson. I have found it a monastic principle that at times the Swami's words are to be literally observed. At other times, they are less significant than other signs that indicate the mood. Sometime in 1957, he had an accident. Like many other monks, the Swami took a daily walk. In the neighborhood of the Berkeley Temple, a break in the sidewalk tripped him up and he fell to his knees, painfully smashing one of the kneecaps. Surgery was required. Knees are complex, and a long period was needed for recuperation. My closer association with Swami Shantaswarupananda began. I was asked to live in the Berkeley Center and attend on him. For 4 months, we shared the living quarters, I cooking the meals, dressing the wound, and so on. He reading and reading as he sat up in his easy chair and limped around for bodily necessities. As I had had a little experience in foot massage, I got the privilege of massaging his feet every evening, and he found this comforting and relaxing. As I mentioned, he was deferential about food, and now he showed the same lack of complaint about his immobility. Never much given to talk, Swami Shantaswarupananda used his recovery for silence, meditation, and his reading matter. We had little conversation. One remark he made, I recall, because it gave me much surprise. He said, "After all, Freud was right, you know." I'm afraid I missed the opportunity to question him about it. I did not examine his books, but from this and other remarks, I understood he had been reading Western psychology and pondering it in his very tidy mind. We discussed the nature versus nurture debate, and on that he remarked, "Heredity gives us the physical makeup, but not the rest of it." On being asked, he did tell a bit about his early work in Rangoon, Burma, mostly hospital work, and the nature of the Burmese people. "In those days I kept no diary, and sadly that report is lost." I recall two of his rare scoldings. When I discarded some portion of his dressings into the wastebasket in his bedroom, there was immediate protest. "What? How can you do that? Do you not have a feeling for the purity of things? It belongs in the basket in the bathroom." Of course it did, but the rituals of purity in his native land remained primary for this monk. I should say that even more remarkable was his ability to leave behind many other traits and habits which other monks have found difficult to alter. The other occasion was on a day when a friend of mine came to visit. The three of us sat in the sitting room getting acquainted. I wanted to play for my friend some unusual piece of music on the tape player. I don't know now and remember why, and I asked the Swami's permission. I could see that he gave it hesitantly. Afterwards, he took me to task. don't you understand that this is an ashrama? In an ashrama, there is a routine, an appropriate time for everything. This was not the right time to be playing music. Obviously, he had agreed to it so as not to embarrass the guest. But my feelings were hurt. I went out into the garden and hung onto the gate and pouted. Only later, after living in other centers, did I come to understand that the temple and the living quarters were, in his mind, one. Physically, they were together. Together, they were the dwelling of Sri Ramakrishna. When the master took his afternoon rest, silence for the whole place was appropriate. I feel sure now that the Swami truly felt that sense of identification of the ashrama with Sri Ramakrishna. Swami Shantaswarupananda dealt gently with the devotees. They, and later his disciples, would surely affirm this. In spite of his sobriety, he had a good sense of humor. He could be witty, and when laughing, was a joy to behold and hear. As far as I recall, he would answer general questions about spiritual life. But if Swami Ashokananda's disciples, of whom there were many in the East Bay, tried to break ranks, so to speak, he was on his guard. Once I asked him a rather personal question, to which he replied, "Swami Ashokananda has been guiding your spiritual life, so it may not be appropriate for me to try to answer that." Three more glimpses of his life in Berkeley. One was after a puja, when we were served prasad. I remember it was ice cream, and I happened to be watching the Swami as he received his cup. I had a strong presentiment that this man was feeding someone else. As he spooned the food into his mouth, the air of deliberation and detachment with which it went in fairly shouted that here was one who had conquered the palate. He seemed to be offering up each spoonful. For me, that was a unique experience. The second has reference to the Aratrika, the Vesper service at the shrine. One day, as I sat behind him on the platform, I had the strongest feeling that it was Holy Mother who was doing this offering. A vision? I cannot say that. Rather, it was the idea that this must have been just how she would have looked at such a time. It was the custom at the temple for the pujari, the priest, after the Vesper service, to wave the incense before the photo of Swami Saradananda in the library, to whom that room was dedicated. There were other pictures too, down the hall, which received the offering of incense. Whenever Swami was absent, Mrs. Harvey, the society's secretary, served as pujari. One evening, the manager of the garden was present in the library. She was famous for her frankness, and she asked Swami Shantaswarupananda, "Swami, why is it that when Mrs. Harvey waves the incense, I distinctly feel a presence in here, but when you do it, I don't?" And Swami gave the heartiest laughter I had ever heard from him, and that was his only reply. Six large, heavy metal and glass chandeliers hang from the high ceiling of that temple. One of my duties was to close the room at night, and one night when I was still on the platform and had not yet turned off the lights, One of the chandeliers suddenly came crashing down to the floor, breaking into shards. It had been exactly above the chair and pulpit used by the Swamis for their talks. I said more than good night to the Lord on that evening. When Swami had recovered his health sufficiently to manage by himself, and with the help of devotees, Swami Ashokananda visited us one day, coming to ask me to return to the San Francisco monastery. Privately, he questioned me. "Does the Swami talk to you?" "No," I replied. And he said, "That's what I thought." Swami Shantaswarupananda lived as if he were keeping the world 10 feet away from him at all times. So it seems to me. He rarely traveled outside the Bay Area. He had a new experience, however, on one trip to the Southern California Center. At a gathering of devotees, the hostess asked him if he would like a little wine which was being served. I do not know what went through his mind. Perhaps, well, let me try it out and see. Later he told me it had burned all the way down and left a bad taste like medicine in his mouth. The last time we were together was at Thousand Island Park, New York, where he came for a few days to meet Swami Madhavananda. The retired general secretary had come from India for an operation. Now he was recuperating at the summer retreat. At that time, my only service to the Berkeley Swami was to show him around the park. When we went up the hill behind the old house, and he saw the tree and large rock where Swami Vivekananda is said to have meditated and had samadhi, he was very much moved. He asked me to have a professional photographer come from the village, take a good photo of it, and send that to him. This was done, and the last I knew, it was hanging in the hall of the Berkeley Center. About a year after the passing of Swami Ashokananda, when the centers he had presided over were separated, Swami Shantaswarupananda presided over the main center in San Francisco for about a year, then retired and went back to India. We learned that a very large band of his brother monks went to greet him there, awed by knowing the life he had lived and his self-surrender to his superior. He wrote to me beautiful letters from India. These were printed in the Atlanta Center's newsletter, Provisions. For example, Lucknow, 1976. Quote, "Nowhere in our order in India or abroad are monks trained with a definite idea of preparing them for teaching. In the training center at Benoamort, the probationers are taught the rudiments of Vedanta and the ideas and ideals in brief preached by Sri Ramakrishna and Swamiji, so that they can build up their lives in the light of them. The main purpose is to supply them a solid basis for building up their lives. If they assimilate the ideas and ideals and grow on the basis of those in their spiritual life, they can teach others, if they like. All are not temperamentally inclined toward formal teaching. We are about 1,000 sadhus at that time in our order. Only a small number is temperamentally suited to teaching. One cannot be forced into a teacher. Spiritual teaching is not a vocation that it may be taught. It has to come from within as a result of inner development and aptitude." Lucknow, 1983. Quote, "From the standpoint of sadhu life, transfer from center to center is a healthy practice. It prevents getting attached to a place and people. Non-attachment, vairagya, is the essence of monastic life. In the West, this practice has not been followed yet because of practical difficulties. Our work there is still in the initial stage. The most important part of a sadhu's life is the inner side, to cultivate which he has renounced the world. Worldly people do not care much for their inner life, except when they are in great distress. For a sadhu, the inner side of life is of utmost importance under all circumstances. For attaining a higher level of inner life, he renounces everything that stands in its way as an obstacle. It is through the cultivation of inner life that he realizes the highest truth for which he has left his hearth and home. Now, in the midst of all the changes in the external side of our life, we have to see that the cultivation of our inner life remains steady and all-important. That mostly depends upon us, wherever we may be. We should never forget that work is only a means, and never the end, which is always the realization of truth. Many a time in active life we become confused about it and behave as if work were the most important thing. End of quote and letter. When I went to India in 1965, I visited him at his place of retirement in the Lucknow Ashrama, where Swami Sridharananda, his devoted pupil, was taking every possible care of him. Parvati Maharaj, as his contemporaries called him, received me with warm affection. Here are some fragmentary notes of a few of his lectures and classes taken down in Berkeley or San Francisco. Primitive man is simple in character, and we admire this in him. As civilization grows, his character grows in complexity, becomes tortuous. But a spiritual person transcends this and becomes a simple character again. Here there is simplicity plus knowledge. Living by a schedule is a form of austerity. It is done by all serious spiritual aspirants. If you can keep to such a schedule for months and years together, you can be sure you are building up willpower, power to conquer temptations. But willpower can be demonic, so the goal, the highest purpose, must be there. Seeking comfort is the sign of worldly life. It is our greatest weakness. The spiritual aspirant seeks truth. Sushupti, dreamless sleep, rarely comes, in fact. Most of us dream and can't even remember most of those dreams. In Sushupti, the antakarana ceases to function, the inner organ. That means the ego is gone. Nevertheless, the sakshi is there, the witness, noting the absence of the ego. On Dvaita. Here, in Dvaita, God, souls, and the universe are all independent and all eternal. God is omnipotent, so naturally superior to the soul, who is of limited power, though he did not create the soul. He made the universe out of eternal atoms, they say. Samadhi is the end. If some texts say that it too must be practiced, it means that samadhi is another step in the development of concentration. Dharana is a state of frequent interruption, but in dhyana, the mind stays on the object for a while. One obstacle is the vain character of the mind, its vagaries, and this is the result of careless living for ages past. In Savikalpa Samadhi, one is no longer aware of the subject who is meditating, nor the act of meditation, only of the object. In Nirvikalpa, one is no longer aware even of the object. Is mind present? Mind means forms. If no form, no mind. Even the spectator is not immune from the influence of a certain environment, whether that is holy or unholy. Swamiji used to say that the ego appears only in the intermediate state, neither in the subconscious nor the superconscious, but we make too much of it. Absence of integration is the characteristic of the unconscious mind. As a human being, man does not really transcend his animal nature. But taking on his divine nature, man transcends both the animal and human natures. Attachment is emotion uninspired. When this misfires, a terrible reaction can occur. Painful, it is suppressed to the subconscious, and there it forms what is called a complex, a source of trouble. Psychological treatment is a patchwork. It doesn't get to the root cause. According to Vishishtadvaita, qualified non-dualism, the whole universe is immortal, being contained in Brahman, who is immortal. The ordinary person lives in both light and darkness. That is, knowledge, my body, and ignorance, I am ill, a mixture. In India, too, we have the concept of sthani dharma. That is, when in Rome, do as the Romans. So long as we remain personal in our thought and in our behavior, how can we realize the impersonal? There is the story of a Muslim saint who somehow got into the emperor's palace at the time of feeding beggars. He laid himself down in a corridor to spend the night. A watchman, finding him there, told him to leave. No one is permitted to stay in the buildings or grounds at night, he said. The saint stubbornly refused to move. The watchman, God-fearing and not wanting to rough up a saint, reported it to the emperor. The emperor had not yet retired to bed, and his curiosity was aroused, so he came to see the holy man. And after a little conversation, the emperor said firmly, "You have to understand that this is not a rest house." "May I ask how long you have lived here?" asked the saint. 13 years," was the reply. "Oh, and who lived here before you?" "My father." "For how long?" 60 years or so." "And his father owned it before that?" "Yes." "For how many years?" "Oh, quite a few, I don't remember." "And still you say this is not a rest house?" The emperor bowed before him and withdrew. About the wife of Navagopal Ghosh, a disciple of Sri Ramakrishna and a companion of the Holy Mother. At her death, she held the picture of her Ishtam to her bosom and chanted all the way to the end. She was a very great devotee. About intuition. Knowledge comes in a flash. What does it mean? It means the exclusion of all plurality for the duration of it. It blots out diversity. So if one hears voices or sees a flash of light, and at the same time is aware of other things, that is not intuitive knowledge. And this is the one I like the best. All we can know about an unreal thing is that it is unreal. On how to live, a person becoming a saint changes in three ways. First is his or her outlook on life. Life is no longer so real, not some place where things are to be enjoyed. And second, the mode of life. Worldliness is not in the world, it is in the human mind. Just see nature. There is no worldliness on its part. Many people think spiritual life restricts our freedom. They always mean freedom for the lower nature. Third, one's environmental atmosphere changes. This fosters dignity, serenity, calmness, which is very important, which keeps us balanced, even if something happens which is inimical to our spiritual life. A Bengali song goes like this. In the temple of your life, keep the candle of worship ever burning. That was a song composed by Rajanikanta Sen. Two-thirds of spiritual practice is negative, that is, purification. I have a comment on that. In this matter, he differed from other Swamis that I have heard who said one-third of spiritual practice is negative. Vividisha sannyasa means sannyasa taken with real intense yearning for realization. That was the original meaning before Buddha made sannyasa available cheaply. Until that strong longing had arisen, sannyasa was not to be given. That does not come without a steady, long foundation of nitya, obligatory actions. It is a whole karmic system. Out of forbidden or nishitta karma, and out of desire-born or kamya karma entirely. We go into naimittika, obligatory on occasion, and nitya karma, eternal obligations, a little of the former, mostly the latter. Thus is built the basis for giving up all karmas. It is because this preparation is not there that people come with temporary longing for God and again go away. After a discussion about Atman in Buddhism and Hinduism, the Swami said, "My personal view is that the individual soul has a provisional reality. Really, there is nothing but Brahman, but one has to admit the existence of the individual soul at a certain stage in evolutionary development. Otherwise, many things of this world cannot be explained." The topic was raised of Gandhi's nonviolence and the attitude of our order. The Swami said, "During the Hindu-Muslim riots after partition, there was some danger of the Belur Mot being attacked. The Muslim mill hands were close by the Mot, and there was real danger. So the question arose. Two proposals were put forward. First, that the Mot acquire minimal arms and have them ready just in case. The other, that we petition the government to come to the defense of the Mot. Both were rejected. Swami Madhavananda, the general secretary, particularly was adamant that we must behave completely as monks. Fortunately, the Mott came through this whole crisis unchallenged. In Dhaka, East Bengal, a miraculous thing occurred. The Ananda Ashram is there, a large institution of women run by a niece of Swami Paramananda. Some Muslim rioters were about to attack the place at night. Of course, the ashrama was completely defenseless. Suddenly, the Muslim band heard an enormously loud voice, just frightening them out of their wits, and they turned back. Next day, someone arranged for all the women to be evacuated. All we know about it is what has been reported. At our own center in Dhaka, the Swami, a young monk from Calcutta Students' Home, became so popular with the Muslims that the Pakistan government, then in power, stopped issuing his visa. He is now in Bombay. This was the 1950s. Our relief work in Dhaka is mostly among Muslims, they being the poorest stratum of the society. Swami was asked if, in the event the rioters had attacked Belumat, he thought our Swamis would have carried out their non-violent intention. He replied, "I hope so. Probably they would have defended the shrine." Now the story of Swami Nirvedananda, one of our prominent Swamis. As a young man, he was first a science student, then changed suddenly to literature. As he studied on, he became short of funds and had to take up tutoring for a living. He taught many subjects. Gradually, a group of young men came to be associated with him, at first his students and then his admirers in a spiritual sense. These were high-minded young men, and they began to look on their teacher as a spiritual mentor or general guide to life. He rented a big house and gradually took on the financial responsibility for these boys. At first, two joined. Eventually, it was seven he had with him. They organized a gymnasium in Calcutta for games and exercise. The teacher had not made up his mind what to do with his life, wondering still whether God is real, and so on and so forth. He used to have a little shrine there with a picture of Sri Krishna. He would write out many of his deepest questions and lay them upon this shrine in front of the Lord, thinking somehow they might be answered. One day, this band of young men went on an excursion to the Dakshineshwar area. While visiting there, they thought, well, why not go and see Belur Mott? So they did. And there they met Swami Premananda. Of course, he was sweet as anything to them. He talked to them a long time. They told him about their teacher. When Swami Premananda said goodbye, he said, "Come again," and finished by adding, "Next time, bring your teacher." At their ashrama, the teacher heard the whole story, but was skeptical. He had no great interest in monks or Belumat, but he was curious. Eventually, at the boy's insistence, he thought, "Who is this Swami Premananda these fellows have taken such a liking to?" So all went to the mott. Swami Premananda greeted him, and in the course of a long talk he answered, in the order in which the teacher had put them on the shrine, all his serious and perplexing questions. Well, that did it. He felt he had found the channel through which the Lord had answered his questions. He met and became very devoted to Mahapurush Maharaj. Then Raja Maharaj, who also loved him, said to Mahapurush, "Tarakda, you please give this one boy to me. I am very fond of him." To this, Swami Sivananda replied, "Why, all the boys who come here are yours only. Do you need to ask for them?" Eventually, Swami Sharadananda asked him to affiliate his ashrama. He and most of the young men with him joined the order, and this teacher became Swami Nirvedananda, later the founder of the Calcutta Students' Home.